This is an ABC podcast. Once again, an American town is counting the terrible cost of gun violence. Uvalde is weeping for the children it's lost. A defiant NRA pushed ahead with its pro-gun conference. Inside, the gun lobby and its faithful defended firearms.
The gun didn't do it. Guns don't shoot by themselves.
Blaming a troubled American culture, former US President Donald Trump stuck to the script.
As the age-old saying goes, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Looking on from the outside, it's hard to understand America's relationship with guns. Gun deaths and school shootings are today commonplace in American communities. Yet despite the number of deaths, America seems reluctant to implement any form of gun control. So what's going on, and what role has the NRA, or the National Rifle Association, played in the political and social debate around guns? Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince. In this Rear Vision, the story of the NRA, one of America's oldest organizations.
The NRA was formed in 1871 by two veterans of the Civil War, and they had both witnessed firsthand the abysmal gun skills of the average Civil War military recruit. Robert Spitzer, I'm Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the State University of New York, and I'm the author of six books on gun policy, including The Politics of Gun Control. So in order to prepare young American males for military service in the future, they decided to form this organization to improve shooting and marksmanship skills, and it was an eye to men being needed for future militia or military service in America.
I thought Americans had always had guns and knew how to use them.
Well, it is certainly true that Americans own guns from the very earliest days, but the idea that the average American white male owned and knew the functioning of guns to a great extent is a myth. And in fact, if you examine the records of our military conflicts from the Revolutionary War to the War of 1812 and up to the Civil War, what you find is persistent complaints about how terrible the militiamen were and most of the military recruits generally. Not only did they lack military skills, they most often didn't know one end of a gun from another.
So by the time we get to the beginning of the 20th century, how large is the NRA and what's its main purpose?
Well, it continued to be mostly a marksmanship organization, the idea being that it was recreational, that learning how to handle guns built the character of young men, that it was a skill useful should military service be necessary. But in terms of the actual membership of the organization, during the early part of the 20th century, it numbered in the few thousands. I don't know that it even reached 10,000, but it was very small. It was nothing like it became much, much later.
From the beginning of the 20th century, gun control was an issue in the US. And one of the first pieces of legislation introduced was in New York State in 1911. It required gun owners to be licensed if they had a firearm small enough to be concealed.
There was crime and gangs in the late 19th century and then going into the early 20th century. So New York state legislators decided to pass this law to control handguns. They thought handguns shouldn't be allowed to be carried unless it's done by a permit. And that seemed like a very sensible law at the time. The NRA took no positions. The NRA stayed out of the debate. My name is Frank Smythe, and I am the author of the book, The NRA, The Unauthorized History. In the 1930s, due to the prohibition and the rise of gangsterism and gangsters like Al Capone, the Saturday Night Massacre in 1929, carried out by Al Capone's men with machine guns of rival gangsters, there was a push for regulation of these weapons. So in 1934, the NRA didn't oppose existing legislation, but backed new law, which established a system to regulate wholesale transfers of guns, and that also outlawed fully automatic weapons or machine guns, which is still on the books.
The NRA generally in its history resisted gun laws in various ways, but its tactics were much more low-key in the 1920s and 30s and 40s and 50s. So if you examine the communications, the NRA with its membership, it expressed support for certain kinds of gun measures, but also expressed ambivalence, questioned how effective they would be, and often proposed scaling back whatever the existing gun measure was that was being analyzed and discussed. But in congressional testimony and in public statements, they would express support for gun measures, including support for what became the first important national gun law passed in 1934 called the National Firearms Act. That was the law that severely restricted fully automatic weapons like the infamous Tommy gun that you see in old movies, sawed-off shotguns, and other similar weapons used by gangsters in the 1920s and into the 30s, where they outgunned the police in many instances. But they did lobby, and pretty effectively so, to strip out of the legislation a measure that would have restricted handguns as well and called for some kind of registration scheme at that time. Again, they weren't happy with it, but I think they understood that it was hard to come up with a good reason for why Americans should legally own, without any regulations, a fully automatic weapon, let's say. And they maintained that position into the 1960s.
In the summer of 1965, in Watts.
Absolutely incredible.
Fires in Nashville, Tampa, Detroit.
Some 20 National Guardsmen have.
Washington, Newark, all profiles of disorder.
What radicalized the NRA was two things. Number one, it was crime in the late 1960s, as well as civil unrest, the Watts riots, the racial tension at the time. It's in this period, and the real thing that provoked it, that radicalized and created the gun rights movement in the United States, was the National Gun Control Act of 1968, signed by President Johnson.
We've come here to the Cabinet Room today to sign the most comprehensive gun control law ever signed in this nation's history.
This outlawed interstate sale of long rifles like the one that was tied to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, and also limited sales of guns to minors. So it imposed some retail restrictions on firearms purchases that didn't exist before. And there was a group both within and outside the NRA firmly, adamantly opposed to these restrictions, which they thought is a dangerous trend of government overreach. And then several years later, the National Rifle Association underwent what is known in the law as the Cincinnati Revolt, or its own internal gun rights revolt, to then become the largest gun rights organization in the country.
According to Matthew Lacombe, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Barnard College and the author of Firepower, How the NRA Turned Gun Owners into a Political Force, this revolt in the NRA was closely connected with the rise of right-wing politics in America in the 1970s.
A new conservative movement, referred to as the New Right, was gaining substantial momentum and organizing itself politically. The New Right tried to bring together single-issue conservative groups and unite them with small government conservatives who favored low taxes and reduced regulations on business. That movement wanted to bring the NRA's constituency into the fold. They saw gun owners as a potentially powerful and valuable political constituency, and they tried to get the NRA on board. The NRA's existing leaders at the time, however, were hesitant to go in that direction. They were hesitant to unite with this conservative movement because doing so would have sort of brought them into alignment with a political party, because the New Right was gaining a foothold within the Republican Party coalition. The pre-existing leaders in the NRA who wanted to avoid a close alliance with the New Right were referred to as the old guard. They wanted to sort of shift gears and to move the organization's headquarters away from the national capital in Washington, D.C., and out to the western United States, and begin to brand the organization as more of an outdoors-oriented organization. However, there was a group of lower-level leaders who were more ideologically intense, more ideologically dogmatic, and who wanted to bring the NRA into close alignment with the New Right and to have it bolster its own political infrastructure and begin to play a more central role in conservative politics and take more ideologically hardline positions. So that conflict between the new guard and the old guard simmered throughout the 1970s and eventually came to a head at the 1977 NRA annual meeting in Cincinnati, Ohio, now known as the Revolt of Cincinnati. This was a moment in which those new guard leaders took advantage of loopholes in the organization's bylaws and found a way to seize control of the organization from the old guard in something of an organizational coup d'etat. Following that event, those new guard leaders found ways to consolidate their power within the organization and quickly took it in a more ideologically conservative direction. And then in 1980, endorsed Republican President Ronald Reagan for the office of the presidency, which was the organization's first political endorsement and the beginning of its alignment with the Republican Party, an alignment that has since grown in strength over time.
The prior leaders of the NRA were almost all of them, with a few exceptions, military personnel, military veterans. But after 77, the man who took over, Harlan Carter, did not have a military background. He came from a Border Patrol background. He had been the Border Patrol chief. So this was a new breed. And since then, the people that have led the NRA have tended to be civilians, lawyers, or people like Wayne LaPierre, who is much more of a political strategist.
This is Rear Vision. I'm Annabelle Quince. In response to the recent school shooting in Texas, we're tracing the story of the NRA, or the National Rifle Association, and asking what role has it played in stopping gun reform in America? It was this new NRA leadership that began to engender a culture of fear into the gun debate.
Well, the campaign essentially became one of fear-mongering. And that fear-mongering only escalated. In the beginning, the NRA started putting out ads about crime and ads about, well, you may need a gun to defend yourself, or at least trying to ring those bells. So you still had this element of the shooting sports in it, but it was infused with gun rights, it seemed, at every twist and turn. And that message was a theme that the NRA rang that bell at every opportunity they did and pounded that home.
Protectors of the Second Amendment, advocating the right to keep and bear arms.
On its website, its own news channels, and in its magazines, the NRA preaches that its 4 million members must resist any restrictions on their weapons.
We are the NRA.
This was part of the NRA's tactic and strategy. If you examine the actual history of the Second Amendment, the handful of court cases that speak to the meaning of the Second Amendment, if you look at the history of American gun laws, everything points to the understanding that the Second Amendment, which actually says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And that sentence, frankly, is not as complicated as people say, but it was always understood to be applicable only in the context of citizen service in a government-organized and regulated militia, written at a time when the government did not have the resources to provide weaponry to the militiamen. And so militiamen were required by federal and state laws to obtain at their own expense military-grade weaponry. But in the 1960s and 70s, the NRA decides to start investing in a handful of lawyers to start writing law journal articles to argue that the Second Amendment really is about something else, that it's either not about militias or in addition to being about militias, it's really about the right of average people to have guns for their own purposes. And this writing explodes in the 1980s. And ultimately, they pumped enough stuff into law journals to make what many considered at least a plausible case for this other interpretation. And finally, in 2008, with the Supreme Court populated by a handful of very conservative justices who now adhere to this point of view, they decide in a 5-4 ruling that, in fact, the Second Amendment is about a personal right of average people to have guns for personal self-defense in the home. The author of that decision claimed it was based on his reading of history. The thing is, it was an accurate reading of history only if you were standing on your head at the time. virtually every reputable history of the colonial era and history of constitutional law disagreed with their interpretation of American history. They essentially distorted the historical record to serve their purpose, but the case is in law, and even more conservative generation of jurists are now in the court system and practicing law, and they are poised to advance this interpretation even further.
In the early 1990s, following several incidents of gun violence, the Clinton administration passed two pieces of gun regulation. The first in 1993, which mandated federal background checks when purchasing a firearm, and the second, the Crime Bill of 1994, which introduced the federal assault weapons ban.
When those gun control laws passed in the early 90s, they passed under unified democratic control of government. One thing that's really interesting is that when a movement or an interest group or an organization engages in what I call threat-based mobilization, which is to say it attempts to mobilize its supporters and keep them engaged in politics by telling them that what they believe in and value is under threat, those sorts of organizations can actually thrive following political setbacks because those losses are evidence that they are, in fact, under threat after those early 1990s gun laws were passed. Gun owners immediately mobilized against them. NRA membership went up, NRA funding went up, political intensity in elections of gun owners went up. So one thing that occurred after those gun control laws were passed in 1993 and 1994 is in the midterm election in 1994, the Republican Party did extremely well. And President Clinton, who was the Democratic president at the time, believed that the losses his party suffered during that midterm election were in large part a product of NRA countermobilization or NRA backlash following the passage of gun control laws. And so after having suffered those losses in the early 1990s, the NRA somewhat paradoxically came back even stronger. And also, importantly, taught Democrats a lesson that pursuing gun control laws might be costly for them politically.
It's a pretty slick website.
Oh, yeah.
Josh Sugarman has spent 30 years studying the NRA's tactics.
The NRA basically lies. And the last sentence in this website says, it is not affiliated with any firearm or ammunition manufacturers or with any businesses that deal in guns and ammunition. And that's just patently untrue.
Sugarman says the NRA is little more than a front for its corporate partners, gun manufacturers who sit on the board.
The NRA has always had a relationship with gun manufacturers, a relationship that we could in some ways call symbiotic. People express the viewpoint that part of the reason the NRA is so popular is that it simply serves as a sort of front group for firearms manufacturers. But I actually find that that's not so much the case. I find that the NRA has more power over the gun manufacturers than those manufacturers have over the NRA, and that when their interests conflict, the NRA can actually sort of keep them in line. So for example, in the early 90s, there was a gun manufacturer, Smith & Wesson, that chose to work with the Clinton administration to try and improve some safety features on their guns. This so offended the NRA that it led a boycott against Smith & Wesson that substantially hurt the company's sales. So in general, the NRA does have a close relationship with those firearms manufacturers, but I think the extent to which that relationship explains the NRA's power is often overstated.
There was a kind of an unofficial partnership, but there was not a close relationship. Ryan Bussey, former firearms executive. I'm author of Gunfight, My Battle Against the Industry That Radicalized America, and I also serve as a senior advisor to Giffords. In 1999, Columbine, our first really serious school shooting happened, our first notorious school shooting happened outside of Denver, Colorado. After that shooting, very much like this year, where the NRA convention was held just after a horrific shooting, that year, the NRA convention was to be held just a few days later, surprisingly, in Denver. It had been planned for Denver, right near the school shooting. Most of the convention was canceled, but the NRA held its business meetings. And we've now learned through enterprising reporters who have uncovered tapes and transcripts from those business meetings that the very top NRA leaders literally had a debate after Columbine about whether to be a part of the solution or whether they would essentially get into the culture war business. Would they use this and say, hell no, and figure out a way to use it to build power? And they opted for the second one. The important part about that for the industry relationship is as that culture war started to crank up, gun sales started to go up because of it, because people were, they ginned up people to be fearful about losing their guns. And from that point forward, the industry itself would never, ever, ever step out of line with the NRA. They became very, very closely partnered. So what was an unofficial relationship really became like a marriage.
In 2000, the NRA backed George W. Bush for the presidency and therein cemented its connection with the Republican Party.
Traditionally, they endorsed more Republicans than Democrats, but you would have some Democrats who were pro-gun, who were against gun laws, just as you would have some Republicans who favored gun laws. But in the year 2000, they became a co-sponsor of the 2000 Republican National Convention and were endorsing almost entirely Republicans, threw all their weight behind George W. Bush. And the Democrat who ran against him for president, Al Gore, supported a menu of stronger gun laws, and it was an important issue for his campaign. And of course, Bush won that election. It was extremely close. And the Bush administration really gave the NRA full run. The NRA's strongest supporter in the U.S. Senate was appointed attorney general. Bush appointed people to the Supreme Court who were very pro-gun. And in 2005, the NRA's top legislative priority was passed by Congress, the pushing of the Bush White House. It was a law that gave special legal immunity protection to the gun industry, making it very difficult to take them to court.
In 2004, George Bush opted not to renew the assault weapons ban, which when it was written as a conciliation towards the Republicans had a sunset, a 10-year sunset. So it had to be renewed by the next president or it would be dissolved. Nobody ever thought that any president would do it, but he did it and he did not sign it. So it dissolved and all of a sudden assault weapons became legal again. Then he signed the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, and that gave broad liability coverage to the firearms industry, which basically protected the industry even from irresponsible marketing. The NRA was very proud of that, and they took credit for it publicly. Wayne LaPierre, who is the president of the NRA, gave a press conference where he took, you know, very bold credit for that and said it was the most significant gun legislation in 20 years.
The NRA really ran the table during the Bush years, and the Democratic Party, which normally would be the vocal opposition, avoided the gun issue because in their reckoning, Al Gore and the Democrats lost in 2000 because of the gun issue. So they really abandoned the gun issue in the first decade of the 21st century. And it wasn't until Barack Obama's second term that Democrats began to find their voice on the gun issue once again.
And that voice came after a school shooting at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in December 2012.
These neighborhoods are our neighborhoods, and these children are our children. And we're going to have to come together and take meaningful action to prevent more tragedies like this.
A visibly shaken President Obama as parents and officials struggle with the news of a terrible shooting attack at a U.S. school, which has killed as many as 27.
When it comes to something like a school shooting or similar terrible event, the NRA's default strategy has been to hunker down, not issue statements, not talk to the media, just go quiet until the initial political storm passes. Because what tends to happen, just as we're seeing right now, is that the country itself is outraged and the attention of most Americans is turned to these terrible shootings. And that intensity of focus by most Americans doesn't last. The NRA then resorts back to its standard practices and activities of stoking its base, keeping them mobilized, of applying pressure on political leaders.
Wayne LaPierre has been running the NRA for 20 years and earns $1 million a year because he's so successful. At the first Senate committee hearings on gun control after Sandy Hook, LaPierre went on the offensive.
Law-abiding gun owners will not accept blame for the acts of violent or deranged criminals, nor do we believe that government should dictate what we can lawfully own and use to protect our families.
The NRA was very forceful. They had perfected this all-or-nothing game, this culture war game that we are now in, this divided politics where it's all-or-nothing. Their brand became that they would say not just no to any gun legislation or any regulation whatsoever, but they would say hell no, and they would fight to weaken whatever existed. And they did that, and they effectively killed even the most modest background check legislation in the United States. They effectively killed that about 3 or 4 months after Sandy Hook in 2013.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
I don't think there's ever been an argument that's been more effectively bunked than that one has in the last couple of weeks. Where did it come from? It came from a marketing agency named Ackerman McQueen, which was based in Oklahoma City and Dallas. They were the longtime advertising agency and PR and strategy agency for the NRA, made millions and millions of dollars every year doing it. And that logo, that slogan came from the brain trust there in strategy sessions after the tragedy in Sandy Hook. There was again another discussion about whether the NRA would be part of the solution or what would they do. And the advertising executives came up with that slogan as a way to double down and actually strengthen the NRA. So you see, the answer to gun violence is that we should have more people with guns. You see, sales are increased by gun violence. You need, and if you have more bad guys, then you need more good guys. And maybe you need 5 good guys or 10 good guys. So, you know, the answer is always you need more guns.
Then, in the lead up to the presidential election in 2016, Donald Trump appeared in U.S. politics.
President Trump and his son, Donald Trump Jr., I think very smartly, very instinctually knew that this sort of, we call it red flyover country, right? But it's a sort of conservative part, the rural parts of our country, that guns and gun rights and shooting guns was a very effective cultural connection, again, in this culture war. And so they courted gun companies, gun consumers, shooters, gun owners. They courted them very effectively. And Donald Trump and Donald Trump Jr. made their rounds to the NRA show, to most of the gun factories. They really did effective outreach to try to say, you know, we're the pro-gun people. The Democrats are going to be the anti-gun people. So they're very closely entwined. The very first large national political organization to endorse Donald Trump, back when everybody thought he was a joke and couldn't win, the NRA went all in on him, and they endorsed with an official spend of about $37 million. That placed them, you know, kind of number one seat at the table during the Trump administration, and they would use that in those 4 years very effectively.
Yet at the very moment the NRA was sitting at the number one table, internally it was beginning to implode. Political infighting and a series of financial scandals rocked the organization.
So it's faced both internal challenges, infighting among its own leaders. It's faced lawsuits launched by state governments. And all of those conflicts have left the organization in a rather difficult position. And moreover, its longtime leader, Wayne LaPierre, has been somewhat credibly accused of engaging in financial wrongdoing, which has only exacerbated the external challenges it faces and accelerated the extent to which there's infighting within the organization. So organizationally, the NRA is in many ways weaker than it's been in a long time. And yet its influence over politics seems to have not waned a great deal, or at least not its influence over Republican politicians. Donald Trump, as you noted, had an unusually close relationship with the NRA and continues to have an unusually close relationship with the NRA, having appeared at its annual meeting just last week. Despite its organizational weakness, it does not seem particularly likely that gun legislation is going to pass in the coming months following the devastating shooting that occurred in Texas.
I think the point of all of this is that it almost doesn't matter anymore. They finally got the country the right side of the political aisle, and the culture war wound into the political zeitgeist to such a degree that they almost weren't needed anymore. And it's not dissimilar. Think of Donald Trump. He wasn't elected. He should be out of power. How much influence could he actually have? But if you're here in the United States, you would understand he still has immense influence over the right side of our political system. And the NRA is the same way. It could be weakened, but the average member doesn't care if it's weakened. It doesn't care about scandals. It doesn't care that there's grift. It doesn't care that Wayne LaPierre is involved in all the nefarious activities that he is. They just don't care. Because once those people are in the culture war, all they care is about hating the other side. They don't care about how bad their side is. And that's the political world that Americans live in now.
Ryan Bussey, former gun industry executive and author of Gunfight. My other guests, Matthew Lacombe, author of Firepower, Robert Spitzer, author of The Politics of Gun Control, and Frank Smythe, author of The NRA, An Unauthorized History. The sound engineer is Simon Braithwaite. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.